For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys.
Listen to Stories from the Pacific on your favorite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Talofa, Malo, Bulavanaka, and good morning. This is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. It is Wednesday, October 22. I'm Kyle Evans. Thanks for tuning in wherever you are this morning. Coming up today, an Australian think tank calls for a Pacific intelligence sharing alliance to counter crime and Chinese leverage. Also, a new gun registration system in New Caledonia drives buyers to the black market.
Some people just hidden their guns. Some people just didn't declare that they had a gun, or they just simply declared their gun like stolen gun.
And Solomon Islands Football Federation turns to another Australian, only this time to lead their women's side.
The way that I like to play football, which is to attack as much as we can, sensibly, obviously, that's their nature. They like to go forward and they like to play attacking football. So I just thought it was a perfect fit.
All that and more coming up today. Pacific Beat comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Let's get started. But first, an ABC investigation has revealed a twice bankrupt Australian man pretending to be a naval admiral managed to secure talks with Fiji's Prime Minister. The man was seeking backing for a bogus international military rescue scheme for which he claimed to have secured tens of thousands of dollars in funding. Unwitting investors say they've lost tens of thousands of dollars on the failed scheme, while questions have been raised about whether the title and fake military-style uniforms might mislead or even break the law. The ABC can now reveal the story of Peter Cowell. Some of his targets say he's taken tens of thousands of dollars off them. This story from Alex Turner-Cohen and Lithe Mavono.
New South Wales man Peter Cowell calls himself an admiral and dresses like one. And for 25 years, he's been peddling a fanciful international maritime aid force known as INTSAR. But he has no naval experience. AM's obtained a recording where he acknowledges this.
A couple of the admiralty have mentioned that they are aware that I, Admiral Peter Cowell, have not served in a naval capacity, but that my appointment is strictly a political one.
In Australia, there's no such thing as an admiral by political appointment. Cowell has recruited several veterans over the years and tried to get two ex-New South Wales police detectives on board, promising them jobs with his bogus maritime force. One of these former policemen is Peter Hogan.
And this INSAR project or opportunity kind of just fell in my lap.
Peter Hogan and fellow retired policeman Scott Rogan met Cowell at a hangar in Bathurst Airport. The admiral had grand plans to build an INTSAR international flight training facility at the airport. Scott Rogan says Cowell's story just didn't check out.
It just didn't seem right. It seemed too big and too aspirational for where we were sitting. We were sitting in a shed in Bathurst.
The two former detectives quickly realised the scheme was improbable and have been looking into Cowell in their personal capacity ever since.
There is a bit of Hollywood script in it. We've chased him around a number of different countries, Thailand and Fiji and different states of Australia. He really embraces the uniform and struts around on with it when he's got it on.
Not everyone was so sceptical. A Canberra veteran says he's owed more than $30,000 from lending money to Cowell, who has since vanished. We'll call him Joel. An actor has voiced his words.
He took advantage of my good nature.
Joel works as a contractor for defence, so he can't use his real name. He was initially committed to the INTSAR concept, even accompanying Cowell on sales pitches, including one with the future Prime Minister of Fiji.
We did this pitch to a lot of people, really. The closest it got was when we actually had engaged with a potential head of state.
Cowell was last seen in Thailand. He has dropped the Admiral honorific and has pivoted, now promoting new investment opportunities, including real estate, books and video ads.
I am the group administrator for our Angel Investors Video Verified group.
Sarah Ferris is a UK podcaster who's also been on Peter Cowell's trail.
One of the key reasons that I really wanted to pull at the threads of this story was because the recruits into this organization, they weren't just veterans. They were veterans that were admirals from navies all over the globe, like top ranking officials. And I just was thinking, if these guys can't see that something's not right, then how can anyone?
Cowell didn't expressly claim to have been in the Navy, instead describing himself as an admiral with INSAR, and the uniforms he wears bear the INSAR insignia. However, some people the ABC spoke with expressed concern that the title and the uniforms could mislead. Peter Cowell did not respond to requests for comment. RSL Australia says pretending to have a military history and wearing a uniform is wrong. But while stolen valour is a crime, it's rarely prosecuted. The AFP says perpetrators can be fined and face jail time.
That report from Alex Turner-Cohen and Lithe Movano.
Do you want to know how to take better care of yourself, whether it's your body or your mind? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has the answers. Pacific Pulse brings together experts, movers and shakers, and the wise aunties and uncles from across the Pacific to break down our health challenges. From how we care for our bodies to the health impacts of culture and island living. Join host Melissa Macon for Pacific Pulse Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat, and moving on now, an Australian think tank says the Pacific needs its own intelligence sharing alliance to tackle threats like transnational crime and prevent China from gaining leverage in the region. In a policy brief, the Lowy Institute says Australia should lead the creation of a formal intelligence sharing network with New Zealand, Papua New Guinea and Fiji. The brief's author and director of Lowy's Pacific Islands program, Mihai Sora, says current arrangements are patchy and inadequate. Here he is speaking with Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts.
It reflects what has been repeatedly identified as a gap in regional security cooperation, which is to say effective, operational, daily and routine intelligence sharing with key security partners.
Now, this would have to lean on a fair amount of trust. And as you know, not all Pacific nations see everything in an identical way to Australia. For example, attitudes on China, there's still quite a bit of divergence between some Pacific nations and Australia and New Zealand. Would that present a stumbling block to this proposal?
It's certainly an area that would be, I suppose, in terms of this proposed arrangement, an area that would be a work in progress. Now, it is one of the objectives behind this proposal. One of the objectives is to achieve closer strategic alignment. Now, what that really means is a shared understanding of regional threats. So in the particular case of China's strategic intent for the South Pacific or for the Pacific Islands region altogether, there's certainly quite a lot of overlap between perceptions in Canberra, in Wellington, in Port Moresby, and in Suva, but not perfect overlap. And we've seen that evidenced in remarks by Prime Minister Rambuka, by Prime Minister Marape in Papua New Guinea as well. So there is an understanding that China has strategic intent for the region, but perhaps not a complete agreement on what the shape of that intent is. So, you know, that's an area that would grow naturally over time. Put simply, you know, it would be a factor of intelligence professionals sitting around looking at the same facts together and coming to judgments that are informed by the same evidence. Now, I should also emphasize that that's not the core plank of this proposed agreement. The core plank, in fact, is better regional cooperation on a range of transnational challenges, whether it's climate change, international drug smuggling happening through the Pacific and in Pacific countries, illegal fishing, and of course, cybersecurity, which is emerging as a rapidly growing threat facing not only Pacific government systems, but the Pacific private sector, Pacific communities, and of course, the Australian counterparts to all of those as well. So the proposed agreement is really about meeting Pacific security needs, identifying the gap, which is reliable and consistent flow of intelligence between trusted security partners to help them better mobilize their resources, to better fill in the blanks on the regional security picture, and essentially to provide for a more stable and secure Pacific region.
Now, as you know, Australia does at times share intelligence with Pacific nations on matters like cyber security or international organizational crime. But what you think that might be a bit too ad hoc, and you think it's worth systematizing in this way?
I think the benefit of a sustained agreement arrived at national level is that this implies a continuation of resources. Now, there are Australian cyber response teams that are deployed throughout the Pacific whenever an incident occurs. You know, there's a timeline for that funding. There's a timeline for those operations. An agreement like this would make that sort of activity routine rather than exceptional. It would make it possible to establish long-term relationships of trust between key personnel working in these sectors. And it would also fill in some of the gaps in those sorts of response activities. I'm talking about mitigation and prevention. You know, there in the chain of a cyber attack, response is the last possible thing that you can do to recover from an attack. But there's certainly a whole lot of resilience and mitigation efforts that you can take to strengthen systems, be it government, business, or community systems. So an agreement like this would make it would make it easier for Pacific stakeholders to access some of those supports from more senior, more established security systems in Australia and New Zealand.
What sort of intelligence would Pacific nations be able to feed into this network should it be established? Acknowledging, of course, the vast gap in terms of just the sheer number of resources and level of all of nation effort that Australia and New Zealand pour into gathering intelligence compared to Pacific nations, which don't have the same more sophisticated apparatuses.
There certainly is a gap in capability, and that is one of the objectives of the proposal, in fact, is to start to mitigate that gap, start to build up the capability and the resilience of the national security sectors in Papua New Guinea and Fiji. In a sense, the proposal is pushing on an open door there, because both Papua New Guinea and Fiji are in full flight right now, reforming their national security architecture, identifying areas where they want to grow a capability, whether that's in intelligence collection, in surveillance, in regional cooperation, in physical systems, in personnel vetting, and so on. Both countries are looking at legal changes, regulatory changes, the architecture of their public service. Now, in terms of what they would be able to contribute from day one of such an agreement, for example, certainly a lot of local level intelligence that is already gathered by different national security professionals in these two countries, be it policing, be it civilian intelligence officials, or be it military. Now, these gaps are critical to connecting the dots. For example, you know, local communities would have knowledge of ships that pass through their communities, through their local waterways. They can pass that information to their local community leaders or directly to a local law enforcement official. They can then feed that into a more centralized network through this intelligence sharing agreement, which would then connect it to regional partners that can help mobilize a response or provide assessment as to the threat, that problem area, or connect it to other activities in the same country or in partner countries, and build up that regional picture.
That was the Lowy Institute's Mihai Sora speaking there with Stephen Jedgetts. Well, it's estimated there's as many as 128,000 unregistered firearms in New Caledonia, making it one of the most armed places in the world per capita. Lax hunting laws and civil unrest between Indigenous Kanaks and New Caledonians of European descent have largely driven the escalating numbers. However, a system is being rolled out to make the acquisition of weapons more secure. But much like the Bougainville Accord, it's unclear whether it's helping or hurting.
Like many in New Caledonia, Emrik Sakarjan grew up with a gun in his hand.
In the north of New Caledonia, when I was like 12 years old, I used to go with my friends, you know, in different property. This is the way I've learned how to use guns.
These days, he's a filmmaker and boxing coach in New Caledonia's capital, Noumea. He no longer hunts, but he rarely leaves home without a gun, especially after deadly riots swept through Noumea last year.
I wear my gun as a concealment. I'm not that kind of guy who's going to use the gun for no reasons. But even though I still have my gun on my wrist, I'm just walking down the street and I feel comfortable and I feel secure. I feel safe because I have a gun. You know what I'm saying?
He's not the only one. Almost one out of every two people own a gun in New Caledonia. Estimates show there could be as many as 128,000 unregistered firearms in the country, on top of the 64,000 that are registered. It was hoped a new registration system would make the acquisition of weapons more secure. But much like the territory's political situation, reform efforts have so far been ineffective.
There were situations in New Caledonia who forced the registration to change toward the firearms. And since then, some people just hidden their guns. Some people just, they didn't declare that they had a gun, or they just simply declared their gun like stolen gun, whereas they may not be stolen, you know? You know what I'm saying?
The registration system he's referring to is called the Weapons Information System, or SIA. It was implemented by the French High Commission and is designed to track purchased weapons over the course of their lifespan by digitising administrative procedures relating to the trade, acquisition and possession of the gun. It will also introduce a mandatory safety exam for firearm purchases and make it so hunters need to join a rifle club before buying ammunition.
It's a weapons information system that is designed to ensure the traceability of arms within New Caledonia, as well as bringing New Caledonia in line with not only French regulation, but European regulation.
That's Sheridan Ward, researcher on non-militarisation and countries without sovereign military institutions. She's conducted various research projects across the Pacific and wrote about the new system for the Lowy Institute.
It's a much newer and cleaner system as well, and it should hopefully be adapted more towards the New Caledonian context, making it easy and accessible for weapons dealers and armories to input information into there, as well as have more comprehensive information about that weapon so that it can be tracked throughout the entirety of its life cycle.
However, the system has only been partially deployed since its rollout in 2019 due to administrative holdups and political upheaval in France. It means most of the territory still operates under the old registration system, which has seen only 5,000 weapons registered over the last year. Meanwhile, in areas where the system has been implemented, Ms. Ward says it's received pushback for making guns too hard to obtain.
When you have all of these extra barriers, particularly mandatory hunting safety exams, the need to present a birth certificate, membership to a rifle club, just creates barriers from people actually wanting to go in and do the right thing and go through the legal avenues. There's also other restrictions that mean that if you are to transfer a gun from one person to another, you're not actually allowed to do that just between friends or family, but you are supposed to go into a gun shop and do that within the presence of a registered gun trader. The result from that means that people are completely detached from this formalised system and there's no incentives to be a part of it. Many of the Kanaks that I've interviewed out in the provinces just find it a bit ridiculous. Like, this is so inaccessible for them and there's really no benefit to them to go into the city and go into a registered gun trader, especially if we're looking at, you know, passing guns between family members for genuine hunting purposes. These extra barriers, if they're not done with benefits, are just going to push more people away from going through the legal avenues and into the black market.
According to Ms. Ward's research, black market sales of firearms have risen since the closure of several armories, which shut their doors after the riots.
One third of all licensed armories have actually shut down permanently in New Caledonia, in part because of the shutdown of licensed armories, as well as looting that happened during the riot. I've been told that there have been many more stolen weapons appear in the black market.
There are ardent gun owners like Emrick Sakajin who believe guns should be harder to obtain.
I think it is a good idea because a firearm still is dangerous. I know there's a lot of crazy people, especially in New Caledonia. People are really aggressive. We are aggressive. I have a lot of rage myself in my heart about what happened in New Caledonia, you know. I'm really angry. And every time I go into Australia or I go into New Zealand or another country, I feel safe. I can walk down the street. You know, I feel really comfortable. But in my own country, I don't even feel comfortable. I feel angry every time.
That was Emirat Sakajan ending that report by myself.
Hold the front page!
It's that time of the morning to take a look at what's making headlines from around the Pacific region. And to do that, I'm joined in the studio by producer Jordan Fennell. Jordan, how are you today?
I'm very well, Kyle. More importantly, though, how are you? You've been off sick.
Yes, that's right. I've unfortunately been on my deathbed for the last couple of days, down with food poisoning. But I am getting better now. It was it was quite the number the food did on us. What started off, it was supposed to be a happy birthday celebration for myself. Ended up putting myself, my wife, and my whole extended family virtually in bed. Everyone except for my wife's old man, who for some reason
escaped.
Managed to avoid it.
Oh,
yes.
Amazing. Yeah, I feel like listeners should know that on Monday morning, you did still come into the office. You were here pushing through, persevering, ready to present despite having crazy food poisoning. It was obviously at the last minute that the stomach trumped everything and I had to take over. But I'm glad to see that you're back and feeling mostly better.
Yes, no, that's right. Still not quite on the solid foods yet, just the toast and the fruit for now. But hey, look, hopefully I can fit in some eggs after the show and maybe a coffee as well. But
yes,
we will see.
Fingers crossed for the early morning.
Anyway, let's get stuck into it. This first story is a big one. The Solomon Islands government is exploring a defence force. What more do we know?
Yeah, this revelation has come about after the National Security Minister, Jimson Tanagata, was questioned in Parliament about this. He says that the move is, quote, not an attempt to militarise the nation, but is instead part of a long-term plan to boost resilience, sovereignty and self-reliance, as he says. Of course, with Solomon Islands, historically, the country has had its challenges in this area. The current police force used to have a paramilitary unit, but after violent unrest and some misuse of firearms, there has been a ban on guns and also a lengthy recovery of public trust in this area.
And what have people had to say about this?
So former Prime Minister Manessa Sogavare has emphasised that if a defence force is created, it must be under firm government control and remain, quote, Melanesia focused. And the current Prime Minister, Jeremiah Manele, says a defence force could help with sub-regional crises and also highlights that among Melanesian states, Solomon Islands is one of the few without a military.
Definitely one to watch, that one. Staying in the Solomon Islands, and tributes continue to pour in following the death of former Malaita Premier Daniel Suardani.
That's right. Solomon Islands is mourning the passing of outspoken former Malaita Premier Daniel Suardani, who passed away yesterday in Honiara. His cause of death has not been disclosed, but his death yesterday came as a Honiara court is due to rule today, actually, on whether unlawful assembly charges against Daniel Suardani related to a 2021 anti-China protest in Malaita should be thrown out. Of course, as Solomon Islands remembers Mr. Suardani, he was known for his very strong stance against the country's diplomatic switch from Taiwan to China in 2019. And also he's been remembered as a strong advocate for Malaita's provincial rights, and the people there saw him as a fearless leader.
Absolutely. It was a stance that we'd shared on this show a number of times. And number three, Fiji's Deputy Prime Minister has resigned and stepped down from cabinet after the country's corruption watchdog charged him with perjury.
Yeah, that's right. So Fiji Times is reporting that Manoa Kami Kamitha has decided to step down from cabinet and comes after Fiji's Independent Commission Against Corruption filed charges against him. Like you said there, those charges do relate to perjury or giving false information to a public servant. Fiji's Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rambuka, says that he will still remain a member of parliament and will focus on clearing his name in relation to the charges that have been laid against him. So we'll see how that all unfolds.
We will indeed. Jordan, thank you so much for joining us this morning with NewsWrap.
Of course.
Here at ABC Radio Australia, we've tripled our Pacific-focused content, which means we're sounding more and more Pacific every day. Tune in across the week to hear a fresh new lineup of Pacific voices and shows on your favourite subjects like sport, music and culture. Go online to abc.net.au/Pacific to find out more. ABC Radio Australia, yours in the Pacific.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We're going to delve into a little bit of sport now. And a little over a year after Josh Smith took over as head coach of their men's national team, the Solomon Islands Football Federation has turned to another Australian, only this time to lead their women's side. Dan Barrett has a long history of working with female teams in Australia, and he led Sydney FC to the A-League Grand Final in 2016 before becoming head coach of Central Coast Mariners Women's Academy. He fought off competition from rival candidates in South America, Europe and New Zealand to secure his new post, and now is focusing on taking the Solomon Islands to the 2027 World Cup in Brazil. But his first task will be to back up the team's success in winning the OFC Nations Cup in July by taking out the MSG Prime Minister's Cup next month. Coach Barrett rates the Solomons as the most exciting women's team in Oceania, and that's what attracted him to the job.
I follow the Oceania region very, very closely, and this is a team that over the last 2 years has shown significant improvement. Good mix of experienced players, but some really exciting young players coming through as well. And the way that I like to play football, which is to attack as much as we can, sensibly, obviously, that's their nature. They like to go forward and they like to play attacking football. So I just thought it was a perfect fit. And when the opportunity arose, I went, yeah, this is the team I'd really like to work with in this region because I see a fair bit of potential here. That's why I applied for the role and was very happy to get it.
And in terms of talent, this team in its current guise has not actually been together all that long. There were a number of years when Solomon Islands didn't have a women's national side, but they've come together. They've made rapid progress. As you say, they took out the OFC Championship. They defeated Papua New Guinea, who'd been the undisputed queens in Oceania for years. And these players are all from Solomon Islands. They're not recruiting from overseas from the diaspora like so many other Pacific countries are.
That's spot on. That's absolutely correct. They're all local players. They started up a women's league here, which I think has played a really vital role in the improvement of the players. So I believe that that league possibly could only be maybe 2 years old, which is where everything has started to kick off. But what it means now for the very first time is that the girls can play regularly. They can play regular week in, week out football and then train regularly with their club sides. And I think that's played a vital role in their rapid growth over such a short period of time.
And the first tournament that you will be involved with, the MSG Prime Minister's Cup, alongside Papua New Guinea. So a chance for Solomon Islands to demonstrate that it was no fluke that they beat them in the final, to actually stamp their mark on women's football in Oceania.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And to do that in Papua New Guinea as well, I think would be a fantastic achievement. It really would be for the girls and for the nation as well. And it's just a great opportunity for me to really get to see this squad play live. And nations like PNG and Fiji, they're nations that we're going to have to beat in order to qualify for the World Cup. So, yeah, very, very important tournament.
And as far as World Cup qualification is concerned, we always have to factor in New Zealand in Oceania, of course. There's still clearly a gap between New Zealand and the Pacific Island countries. But in just a few weeks' time, the New Caledonian men's team will be competing alongside five others in the final World Cup playoff. And who knows, they could make the World Cup in US, Mexico and Canada next year. Do you see the Solomon Islands women's team as potentially being the women's New Caledonia, if you like, when it comes to World Cup qualification?
That's absolutely my goal. That intercontinental playoff spot is, you know, is a great opportunity to make the World Cup. Yes, New Zealand are there, and if you just look over the previous years, they're the team that seems to qualify. But I think that intercontinental spot is something that we can absolutely aim for. And for me, that's the goal, to get to that spot, and then anything can happen. But I really believe that that's a great opportunity for Solomon Islands if we can get to that part of the competition.
You're on a six-month contract. Does that mean you're on trial? Do you feel that you're on trial? Or is this a kind of opportunity to see how you fit and Solomon Islands football fits with you?
It's a performance contract. So I think it's all of that, to be honest. I think it's all of that. But for me, I really just want to do well and see where that takes me here.
And the biggest critics you're likely to come across in Solomon Islands are the fans. They expect a lot from their teams. Is that something you're ready for? Because I know, for example, one previous coach I can think of in the end, I think it just wore him down.
25 years I've been doing this, particularly working for A-League clubs in Sydney. My skin's become quite thick over the years. Look, for me, it's always about if I'm giving 100% and I really believe that I'm adding value, And it might be value that other people can't see, but if I feel like I'm getting my messages across, that's where my focus is, and I don't get diverted by that at all. And to be totally honest with you, I don't read it. I'm disconnected from social platforms and stuff like that. I'm just all about what happens on the grass and improving the team week in, week out.
Will you be based full-time in Honiara during at least the first 6 months? Obviously, I assume you're hoping it will lead to more than that, but that's what we have at the moment.
This six-month window, there is so much going on. I've got a lot to keep me busy, and the more contacts I can have with the group, and particularly in lead-up to World Cup qualifiers, is vital. So I'll be staying here in Honiara full-time.
That was Dan Barrett, the new coach of the Solomon Islands national women's soccer team, talking to Richard Hewitt. And with his A-League connections to call upon, Dan is hoping to open some doors for the best Solomons players to secure professional deals in Australia. Well, it's been 8 years since Surfing Papua New Guinea hosted the World Longboard Championships at Venemo, but they are in talks to bring the event back in 2026, and this time it will be staged at Kavieng. But while those negotiations continue, Surfing PNG's president, Andrew Abel, says their immediate focus is on elite training and development programs.
Our Papua New Guinean surfers, we have attended the International Surfing Association Olympic Solidarity Training in Fiji recently. Our national coach, Shane Clark, and two young surfers, one female, Shane Clark's daughter from Kavieng, and also young JY from Tapira. And they trained with all the surfers from within the region, the 12 members of the Oceania Surfing Federation. That was in Fiji at a famous break called Club Break. And that's the pathway to the Olympics now. Surfing is part of the Olympics, as you know, following the inaugural surfing Olympic event at Te Hupu in Tahiti at the last Olympics. Our international surfers who went out were young JY from Tapira and Kailani from Bonnie Clark from KBN. That's the latest for our international. We now, as I said, we're gearing up now for the second event, which is the Oceania Surf Cultural Surfing event, which we plan to stage here in Papua New Guinea. We're looking at KBN, but it could also be in either Tapira or Vanimo. We're aiming for the 26-27 season. So the monsoon surf season goes from November through to April.
Will there be any national events hosted to probably identify your top surfers, or do you already have athletes who are in training at the moment?
We have identified our elite longboard and shortboard surfers, but the national titles, which will be the selections in the 26-27 season, that will be the selections for the Oceania event and the planned longboard event, and also it's the selections for our team that will be going to Tahiti for the Pacific Games in 2027.
Tell us about the interest from our surfing clubs. How many surfing clubs do you have?
Surfing PNG, we've marked 36 years since foundation, and we now have 11 clubs nationwide. Most recent club was opened in Bougainville, in central Bougainville on Pok Pok Island, and we're supporting them with donated surfboards. And in 2017, we donated around 50 surfboards to a whole host of surfing communities from central Bougainville, Pok Pok Island, up to Vito Beach, up to a whole lot of villages, right up to Bora. And so growing support for surfing is spreading, and I'm very happy to say that Bougainville has embraced surfing now, and we have around 500 plus surfers nationwide and probably around 50 females riding long and longboards and shortboards.
We've got so many great surfing sports in Papua New Guinea, but any plans on bringing over our top elites to Australia, which is right near our doorstep, for either training or just other engagements in terms of experience?
We have a relationship with Surfing Australia at the High Performance Training Centre down at Casuarina Beach at Coolangatta, and our surfers have trained there in the past, and they've got a brand new training facility there worth about $6 million Australian dollars. We're collaborating with Surfing Australia and including Surfing New Zealand with a view of having our surfers from our respective Pacific Island nations to compete with the Australian clubs down there, but also more importantly, engaging with the Indigenous Maori surfers and the Indigenous Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island surfers. And I think this is very important because culture is centre to our existence, the integration of culture and band food, tattooing, etc., into the actual surfing competition that we are planning to stage here.
Well, What can you tell us about your Pink Nose surfboards and the idea behind that?
The Pink Nose Revolution was a policy that I developed, and I launched it in 2014. The Pink Nose Revolution policy is essentially a policy geared to educating the young and reforming the old and towards empowering women with equal rights and opportunities. And we launched that officially at the inaugural 2017 PNG Kumul World Longboard Championship in Tapira. And I hope to have this established and operational throughout Papua New Guinea with all the national sporting federations in driving the Pink Nose Revolution to addressing this global pandemic of gender-based violence, which is undermining our homes and fabric of society and communities. The other policy, apart from Pink Nose, was No School, No Surf policy, and that's essentially focused on education. And that policy is essentially, in our surfing communities nationwide, is to encourage our young boys and girls in the communities to prioritise education and support their parents in the investment that parents make in their education by making sure that they go to school in lieu of access to surfboards.
That was Andy Abel, president of Surfing Papua New Guinea, and he was speaking there with Godwin Eki.
Join Jacob McQuire and Michael Chow for Nisha Daily every weekday morning on ABC Radio Australia.
When's Emily getting a show?
Well, she kind of runs this one.
She does run this
one. I don't mind being in the background, guys. I can just roll my eyes and shake my head at all the things you say. I'm happy with that.
But you know how some places have like a swear jar? We need like an eye roll / head shake jar for Emily.
Nisha Daily, weekday mornings from 7 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We're going to head to Australia now because First Nations women are three times more likely to die in childbirth, and their babies are almost twice as likely to die in their first year of life. But Aboriginal Health Services are working to change this by establishing culturally safe birthing on country programs. And earlier this week, an Aboriginal Health Service hosted its first smoking ceremony for babies and toddlers. Reporter Hannah Ross was invited to go along.
A young girl in white Crocs is stomping and twirling to Yothu Yindi and Baker Boy. Families with babies and toddlers are gathering in the sunshine while elders prepare to set fire to a basket of fresh eucalyptus leaves. This is the first time the Bulana Aboriginal Health Service in northern New South Wales has held a smoking ceremony to welcome babies and toddlers to their country.
I'm Jalissa Armstrong and I'm from Ballina, and my little bub is Violet Armstrong. She's 3.5 months. Violet is my first baby. She is actually also the fifth generation of the eldest girls within my family line. So yeah, it's a pretty special day for us. Just welcoming my baby to her country and her ancestry and what her future will be like spiritually as well. Yeah, and just how I want her to grow up, just believe that she is a strong black woman.
Malika Kelly, I live here in Ballina on Bundjalung country, and this is Yaram Batai, Kelly Packy. He's my fourth and my last.
Did you have this sort of thing when you were growing up?
No, absolutely nothing. It's really nice to, so we can get a bit of our culture back with something. Just, I think, people raising their voice now. I just want to be recognised and just to show that our culture's still there, even though majority of it's got taken away. So it's good just to have these little events to feel a bit connected.
Do you reckon these little ones will have a different sort of life to you in that way?
Yeah, it's already has because we never did any of this.
Joey Gordon, got a 20-month-old son, then a 4-year-old son. Just brought them along to get them involved in the project and also culture. I'm trying to teach them traditional ways, even though we live a bit of a contemporary lifestyle as Indigenous people. It's good to know some of the traditional ways we used to live.
How did you feel seeing your son getting the smoking?
Yeah, it was good. He was a bit, how are you going, because he was ready for bed, but it's good to be a part of.
Do you think the little Jarjums are going to have an easier time of it?
I hope so. I think we're in a really good period where we're able to celebrate Indigenous culture a lot more.
After the ceremony, a group of aunties daub ochre paints onto the faces of the Jarjums.
I'm Amber Cameron, so takes my breath away. I'm really stuck for a word, but I'm also honoured, you know, and privilege to do things like this for the babies. Because where I come from originally, Cabotry Island, I've never grown up, you know, to do these things and to welcome them. And it's an honourable thing anyway for the mothers to allow the little ones to be noticeable, you know.
My name's Tara Gordon, Elder Care Support Coordinator.
What's it like seeing them with the babies at this sort of event?
Their eyes light up. You can see the magic, you may as well say, because it makes you feel younger. You can see that when the elders are around the babies and they just want to, like, be a part of it, and watching them run around and dance and, you know, and then their faces are just, like, bigger smiles, you know, from ear to ear.
How significant is it for them, do you think, because maybe some of these practices they weren't able to do when they were young? How have things changed?
It is very significant, especially for, you know, our elders and our women who didn't get to do traditional practices back when they were having babies. So to see it being established and Bulina taking the lead in the Northern Rivers, I think it gives the women, the elders, hope that our next generation is going to be connected more to culture, to traditional practices, speaking more fluently in lingo, which is something, you know, that they were told not to do. I just think it shows them Australia has listened, they've heard a bit, and they're willing to make some changes to help us.
I guess they want to see that in their lifetime.
Yeah, they do, those big changes, especially the elders that have fought to have basic rights for our people.
That was Hannah Ross bringing us that report, and that does bring us to the end of Pacific Beat today. Time to take a look back at our main stories. An ABC investigation has revealed a twice bankrupt Australian man pretending to be a naval admiral managed to secure talks with Fiji's Prime Minister.
There is a bit of Hollywood script in it. We've chased him around a number of different countries, Thailand and Fiji and different states of Australia. He really embraces the uniform and struts around on with it when he's got it on.
Meanwhile, an Australian think tank says the Pacific needs its own intelligence sharing network to tackle threats like transnational crime and prevent China from gaining leverage in the region.
It reflects what has been repeatedly identified as a gap in regional security cooperation, which is to say effective, operational, daily and routine intelligence sharing with key security partners.
Yeah, it was a big show indeed today. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. That'll be with Richard Hewitt. Stay tuned, though, on ABC Radio Australia because the news is next. And coming up after that is Nesia Daily. You'll find all our top stories on our website. Just type Pacific Beat and ABC Radio Australia into your search engine or via the ABC Pacific page, which is at www.abc.net.au/Pacific. There you can listen to Pacific Beat Live or catch up on full Pacific Beat programs and individual stories. You can also find us and follow us on Facebook. Find and like the ABC Pacific page and you'll be able to get our stories in your feed. With that, I'm going to say goodbye. My name's Kyle Evans and I'll catch you tomorrow.